Welcome to the Union Jews Podcast. The UK's only all things union show. Carefully curated for your digital downloadable listening pleasure.
Hello, hello everyone, and welcome to Union Jews, the UK's only all things union podcast. My name's Simon Sapper, and you're very welcome to today's show. Our featured guest this time round is sometimes described as the last man standing when it comes to industrial correspondence in Britain. At one point, no self-respecting national or regional newspaper wouldn't have an industrial correspondent and an industrial editor as well. That's all long gone. And we'll hear from Alan Jones about his long and distinguished career, mostly working for the Press Association, or PA. It's a fascinating tour through the industrial landscape and history of our country, with Alan describing how covering labour disputes and labour issues was just a natural run-of-the-mill thing for him working on a local paper in North East Wales. How his arrival at the Press Association coincided with the wave of strikes known now as the Winter of Discontent in the late 70s, and how the miners' strike in 1984 to 1985 was a pivotal moment in terms of labour reporting. You'll also hear why he regards much of current reporting on trade unions as appalling, that's a quote by the way, and how his biggest story was not actually something on the union front, but his dealings with Julian Assange, the journalist and campaigner most closely associated with WikiLeaks, as he sought refuge in the Ecuadorian embassy in London. If you're at all interested in industrial reporting, in journalism generally, in our social history, and of course how unions engage with the press, this is a discussion you will not want to miss. But first of all, let's start off with Professor Mel Sims' Thought for the Week. This time round, Mel is reflecting on exactly how deep we need to dig to protect democracy and our rights at work, and just why engagement with the media and social discourse is so important.
A lot of us who listen to the Union Dues podcast know more about trade unions than many people. And I don't know about you, but I've spent a lot of time over the past couple of years explaining a lot of things about industrial relations to journalists, HR managers, as well as members of the public and my family and friends. On one level, I'm delighted that people are finally interested in important questions about how collective bargaining works, how the UK laws around industrial action have changed, how unions build for strikes, and broader questions around democracy at work. But the lack of knowledge is truly remarkable, and it worries me for a number of reasons. One is that the general quality of public debate is really weaker than it should be. On a really basic level, for example, too many people don't realise that, in the UK at least, when workers take strike action, they don't get paid. And that matters to how people understand the risks that workers are taking when they vote to take collective action. But the lack of knowledge is more embedded than that. Many HR managers have had no reason to need to learn about industrial relations or collective dispute resolution. Even in unionised sectors and organisations, many HR specialists have relatively little experience of strike action, although that might have changed in recent years. Along with other colleagues, I've done webinars and training sessions for HR professionals, journalists, advisors and others. And I've even occasionally had a politician get in touch to ask me to explain something to them, which is great, but it does little to increase the overall level of understanding in the wider population. That's a far wider collective job. Good media reporting with the kind of specialist skills discussed in this episode can go a really long way to explaining things clearly to non-specialist audiences. Other agencies such as ACAS in the UK do a really brilliant job of providing education and training to both employers and workers, albeit within limited resources. And we can all do our bit to help others understand the dynamics of industrial relations. But I can't help feeling that it damages all of us that there are relatively few spaces where the basics of industrial relations are presented. As a result, ideas like industrial democracy and social dialogue, along with their social and economic benefits, are still too often the domain of us specialists. I've certainly made it my job to try and educate widely, not just in the classrooms where I get to teach. And more of us working in that space, the better. But there is certainly a lot of work to do, and we need to keep working away to increase the broad understandings of these issues in our communities.
Thank you so much, Mel. I couldn't agree more with every word of that contribution. The bizarre things that all of us who are active in unions get asked about, why strikes happen, about the powers, the mythical powers of general secretaries to just cause industrial havoc with a click of their fingers, about the legal framework within which unions have to operate. There is a real deficit in terms of public understanding and public debate, of course, about these things. And I'd be interested, listeners, in your stories about what's the most bizarre thing you've ever been asked about either your work or trade unions or industrial relations generally. You can email your submissions at unionjews@makesyouthink.com, or you can post them on X at Jews Union. Love to hear what you think on this one. Now, to our featured guest for this episode, Press Association's Alan Jones, deservedly universally respected, I think, and admired for the tenacity and the consistency of his reporting. It was a great pleasure to squeeze myself into his crowded schedule, and I hope you enjoy the discussion that follows. Alan Jones, thank you very much indeed for joining us on the Union Jews podcast. You have been described as the last man standing in Labour reporting, but how did you get into being a Labour correspondent? What was your journey, as it were? And how did you get going all these years?
It's a very long journey, so you'll have to forgive me if my memory fade. But, you know, I do trace it back genuinely to my kind of roots. You know, I grew up in Northeast Wales, a very industrialised area. Very Labour family, always voted Labour, always bought the Daily Mirror, didn't know anything other. All my friends, family, you know, there were no, I don't think there were any Conservative councillors, and I never met anybody who was a Conservative, let alone who voted a Conservative. So that's how I grew up. And when I started, and I got no idea why I wanted to be a journalist, by the way, I didn't know any journalists. I wasn't particularly good academically. You know, I liked school for the different reasons, but I was actually very keen to become a reporter. I don't know why. I had one day work experience when I was 15, and kind of one day was enough, really. Kept going back to that paper on in school holidays, eventually started work there, covering very hard, covering industrial stories, you know, mixing with trade union leaders, local trade union leaders, local Labour politicians who ran the councils, you know, quite... not corrupt exactly, but not particularly nicely sometimes. So, you know, it was just a normal, wasn't anything out of the ordinary for me. What was out of the ordinary was when I first met a Conservative councillor, one councillor on a council in Northeast Wales. You know, as I said, I just never come across them before. So I used to physically go to these big factories, shot and steelworks, you know, literally every couple of days to meet people, went to the trade union office. The trade union officials were very important. I still remember Jack Jones, the former Transport and General Workers Union legendary leader, arriving for a visit at Shot and Steelworks not long after I'd started work. And it was almost like a royal visit, you know, unbelievable. All the bosses were in awe of this man. So that was the kind of era I grew up in, you know, very strong trade unions nationally, very strong trade unions locally. So it was natural when I went to Press Association that's an area I kind of went into fairly quickly, because there was a lot of industrial news around when I joined PA late 70s, early 80s.
Yeah, sure. It was a sign of the times, I guess, wasn't it? Unions were much greater stakeholders then than perhaps they are now. What was your approach in kind of establishing and maintaining good relations with unions, and who have been the best and the most challenging to work with, if not by name, then by issue?
To be honest, I think I get on with anybody, because, you know, obviously Press Association being very fair and neutral, we have to have every side to every story. So, you know, any story I cover, so the strikes for the last year, obviously, you know, the big rail strikes, I have to make sure I can speak to rail bosses just as easily as I can speak to Mick Lynch, you know, and I do, and I always have, actually. And, you know, I don't know, it's not a strength. I think it is one of my strengths that I'm easy talking to a chief executive as I am to a general secretary of a trade union. But it's something I think is very important, certainly for PA. And, you know, vast, vast majority of union officials at any level I've ever spoken to have been very easy to get on with, very helpful, you know, increasingly difficult for them to get their story out. Yeah. So I kind of almost think, you know, it's one of the reasons I've stayed doing this job for so long is that, you know, I mean, I can't say on behalf of PA, but on behalf of me, some of the coverage trade unions have got, certainly since the miners strike, the miners dispute, which I think was the kind of when unions started to wane in power and interest in the media. Some of the coverage has been appalling, really. So, you know, it's a joy in a way for me to speak to union officials every day as I do and to try and put forward, you know, what they're doing. Because as I said, the vast majority of them are hardworking. I think they're the most underpaid, you know, all these ludicrous stories about how Len McCloskey was given a pension, you know, when he left. They're just ridiculous. Really. They're very, very, very hardworking people. I can't say I've ever come across anyone who's really annoyed me or who I've thought is incompetent. Obviously, you get some, I suppose Arthur Scargill would be the classic, you know, who didn't speak to the press, didn't like the press, probably for good reasons as far as he saw it, but was very arrogant, rude, you know, wouldn't even speak to people like me, who wanted to give him a fair hearing. And I know there are union officials even around today who don't trust the media, will not speak to the media, and probably won't even trust me. So that, you know, that's a bit frustrating, but it is very, very small number, I think.
Yeah, I mean, but why do you think it is? I mean, do you think it is important to maintain a specific journalistic focus on the union world? And if it is, can it survive?
I mean, I think it's massively important. You know, I mean, the strikes of the last 15 months now have really brought it into focus. You know, yes, I have been described as the last man. I mean, I probably am, you know, in terms of national newspapers. You know, the Daily Mirror haven't had anybody for years covering trade unions, for example. The Guardian haven't. No. The BBC only fairly recently appointed someone just to cover the strikes. Obviously, we've got papers like the Morning Star who, you know, do cover it. But in terms of national coverage, I was the last one. And I think it's partly, you know, as I said, since the miners' strike, unions were found it much more difficult to operate, really. All the rules that were brought in, all the laws that were brought in by Thatcher and kept by Blair, which are still a bone of contention, you know, the hoops they have to jump through to have any kind of industrial action. But the importance of it, yes, it's, you know, I've obviously been asked about this a lot. If you're a specialist reporter, whatever speciality you are, you know, crime, education, health, whatever, that's all you write about. You know as much as many, many people in the industry about what's going on. So, as I said, I speak to everybody on all sides of any story I'm writing. So I'm able to write stories from every angle. If someone coming in who didn't know the background to a story, didn't know the importance of a certain official saying something, which was important, obviously, it doesn't get reported as strongly as it does. And not having a group of correspondents covering an industry, I think, has totally shattered the way unions are perceived in the media. When I first started covering industrial stories in the 80s, the industrial group of reporters, it was the job of an industrial editor was the top job on every newspaper. And some papers, the Financial Times had three industrial reporters, an entire page every day just of union stories, if you like. And that slowly went downhill, slowly stopped. More subjects became more important. The city became much more important. Issues like the environment. And it was left, I think, when the Daily Mirror got the last industrial reporter on the Mirror when he left a few years ago, that really was it. I still go to union conferences and it's basically me and the Morning Star.
I suppose it's a bit of a chicken and egg situation, isn't it? What came first? Were the industrial reporters group thinned out by natural wastage or more assertive behaviour by newspaper proprietors or editors? Or did the union decline presage the thinning out of industrial reporters? Because you're right. I mean, there's you, and the only other name I can possibly think of is Sarah O'Connor from the Financial Times.
And she's an economics reporter.
Absolutely. Really. Yeah. Yeah.
So I don't know. I keep going back to the miners' strike because I think that was the kind of the time when the NUM was defeated, which it was. Once that happened, you know, the biggest, strongest union in the country, taken on by the Conservative government and defeated. After that, legislation started to come in. Union membership started to fall. There was less interest generally in trade unions. Certainly less interested in newspapers. Rupert Murdoch started to have a bigger influence on the media. So all those things, I think, combined led to there being less and less interest. So yes, as industrial reporters either retired or moved to other subjects, they weren't replaced. The classic was a guy called Charlie Ray, who was the industrial editor on The Sun. So they became less interested in industrial stories. He became their royal editor, you know, which was a kind of extreme example. But a lot of industrial correspondents I worked with in the 80s just basically retired or were made redundant because there was less interest in what they did.
And yet now, as you say, in the last 12, 15, 24 months, there's been a resurgence of union activity. There's been a resurgence of interest in the media. Is it all about strikes, or do you think there's something else in the mix?
I mean, it's been mainly about strikes, not just about strikes, but, you know, actually, it's not just about strikes. I think this all started, kind of traced it back to Brexit, really, because obviously Brexit was hugely controversial, had a big impact on the world of work. So unions were kind of asked for their views on that. Then we had the pandemic, and people forget that unions were involved in drawing up the furlough scheme, for example. So the TUC heavily involved. So there was more interest in what unions thought and what they did. And then not long after that, all the strikes started. So June of last year was the first big RMT rail strike. Lots of issues coming together, you know, inflation going way into double figures, cost of living crisis almost out of control. All these people worked during the pandemic expecting a decent pay rise, not given anything. So after that, it did become about strikes, but, you know, it wasn't just strikes' sake. You know, there were proper reasons why people were going on strike. You know, we've seen the most extraordinary number of people on strike in the last 15 months or so. You know, you probably forget, but barristers were on strike, standing outside the High Court holding placards. You know, obviously junior doctors and consultants are still involved in strikes. Teachers, nurses, civil servants, you know, people who've just never been on strike before. And it wasn't just pay, it was their workload as well. You know, kind of chickens coming home to roost, as a lot of the unions say. You know, Paul Nowak, the TUC General Secretary, was asked about at their conference the other week what life would be like under Labour, you know, and he was saying nobody expects things to massively change under Labour, but it would be a breath of fresh air for unions after 13 years of, in their view, being attacked by Conservative governments.
Indeed. What, if you look back over the stories you've covered over the years, are there any that particularly stand out? As in terms of importance or impact or changing the narrative or perception of the public?
Yeah, I mean, the biggest ones I've covered have not to do with industry. I was in Belfast. I used to go to Belfast quite a lot, and I broke the story about Julian Assange turning up at the Ecuadorian embassy. So those would be the biggest stories I've ever covered. But in terms of, I mean, just the big strikes, you know, the big fire service strikes, the very first one I covered in
late 70s, that would be, wouldn't it?
In the late 70s, when they brought in these green goddess vehicles, you know, and I was chief reporter on a local newspaper in Guildford, and it was probably the first really big national strike which had local connotations that I was in charge of, if you like. And, I can still remember sending reporters out wherever the green goddesses were based and getting them to follow them around. And, you know, that was huge. I remember thinking, why on earth is the government allowing firefighters to go on strike? And then, of course, there's been several strikes of firefighters since then. Yeah. I mean, I think the miner strike would have to be the big one because it was so long and vicious. And
that set new benchmarks in all sorts of negative ways, totally. In terms of the industrial relations and civil liberties landscape, you could say as well.
I mean, totally. You know, I mean, I literally covered it virtually every day for a year. And used to go, I was at Orgrave for the Battle of Orgrave. Used to follow Scargill around, picket lines everywhere. Was chased by pickets because they perceived the press to be part of the government's machine. And it was huge, you know. So the violence, the viciousness, the demise, you could see as it went on, you could almost see what was going to happen, and the demise of that industry, these proud people reduced to, you know, throwing bricks at families, not speaking to each other. I mean, I went back to coalfields for several years after that to cover what was there, you know, what happened to coalfields. And it was devastating, literally devastating. You know, some people never worked again. Some people never talked to their family again if they worked or didn't work, you know, whichever side they were on. And, you know, in a way it still resonates, you know, coal is still a big story. And the fact that the National Union of Miners has, I don't know, a couple of thousand members now is a kind of, you know, it's a legacy of what happened there. So that would be the one big dispute which I will remember forever, really.
You mentioned Julian Assange and breaking the story of him going into the Ecuadorian embassy where he was held up for so long. How did you come to be in the right place at the right time for that? And why do you think his story is so important?
I mean, I had a contact. He was actually a trade union contact who had a contact with the Ecuadorian embassy who contacted him to say, do you think we could get some publicity about this? So he told me, and it's probably the biggest story I've ever broken. You know, I waited for Julian to arrive and then wrote the story. And within about an hour, 30, 40 international TV crews were outside the embassy. I used to go into the embassy quite regularly to interview Julian. I mean, I think it's an absolute, again, it's me speaking, PA doesn't take a view on these things. We're not a kind of campaigning type organization for different, you know, things. But personally speaking, and as a journalist and as an NUJ member, it's an absolute outrage that he's being kept in a high profile, high secure prison, you know, when he's a journalist. And I think it's an absolute scandal. Absolute scandal. We're waiting for a date any day now, might even come today, when his final appeal may or may not be heard. And then after that, he'll be extradited to the United States and will probably spend the rest of his life in prison for being a journalist. You know, I think it's an absolute outrage.
Yeah, so the importance of the story is it cuts to the quick in terms of the fundamentals of journalism in a democratic and relatively free society.
Yeah, totally. If he was a British citizen in Iran or Iraq or something, we'd have stories every week here about the appalling treatment of a British citizen who's doing his job. You know, whatever you think about what he did, you know, his argument, his supporters' arguments, every free speech organization in the world now supporting him, you know, he was given information about what he perceived as war crimes and published it. And there's an argument that he should be decorated, not detained.
Do you feel almost like a sense of responsibility to, as well as reporting the facts and the development of the case and all the rest of it, but there's a responsibility to do what you can to keep this in the public purview?
I do very much. You know, I've met his wife Stella lots of times, and I ring her a lot. There was an event last Saturday which I wrote about and got coverage for. I do actually think it's important for me to keep the story, because you know, I'm pretty sure that's one of the things the government wants, is for it to fade into the background and for him to suddenly disappear. And you know, as I said, it's such an important story for me personally, but I think for journalists as well. The way he's being treated, you know, it's just shocking. He's very sick. He's got two kids, and he's locked away 23 hours a day in a cell as if he's the most dangerous person in the country. You know, I honestly think it's appalling.
You mentioned how quickly the news spreads, and it is noticeable that your footprint, as it were, as a journalist is very large, both in the UK and internationally. And that comes, I suppose, as a result of PA having a global reach. Is there a downside to those sort of news gathering and news sharing organisations?
I mean, the downside is if you make a mistake, because it's then repeated in 500-odd organisations, which obviously... I'm human, so, you know, I'm not going to say I never make mistakes. But, yeah, the upside is incredible reach we have generally. But, yes, me personally, because of what's been happening, has been quite phenomenal, really. I get a bit twitched sometimes, you know, if a PR sends me a note saying, oh, thank you so much for that story. We had 537 hits, you know, I'm thinking, oh, my God, you know, the number of people using my stories, A, is wonderful. But as I say, B, if there was an issue, I'm not sure there is a downside, really. I mean, we don't do a lot internationally. I mean, the Assange thing is probably the biggest one I've ever done, which was, you know, we sold out literally around the world. I was interviewed by Australian media, you name it, really. But we're very much UK-focused. And because of the way the media has kind of moved on, we get more stories now, I think, published in all kinds of places. So online is massive. You know, there are so many online publications. Newspapers have online outlets as well, so any one story I write can be used literally several hundred times. And yeah, as I said, the downside is if there's a problem with it, trying to rectify a problem when that many people have used a story, as you can imagine, would be an absolute nightmare. And it does happen.
Yeah, for sure. And I suppose the feedback you get, or the responses you get, what's the most surprising place or one that you've received? Are you beyond that now, in the sense that you recognise people anywhere in the world could read the stuff that's posted online?
Yeah, no, I do get that. I suppose I'm trying to think. I don't know how it happened, but Russia Today got hold of one of my stories, and it wasn't the Assange story. It was a strike story, and you know, a lot of people were very suspicious about Russia Today and how they were explaining stories, and they called me and told me they were using one of my stories and asked me to do an interview. As it happened, I couldn't do it. I wouldn't mind it, to be honest, but I couldn't do it. But that was probably the most surprised. I mean, every time an international radio station or TV station contacts me, I think, oh my, you know, how on earth did they get hold of that story? So, you know, in terms of the British media, obviously all the national newspapers, all the major regional papers use our stories. So I get stories in all of those publications certainly every week.
So if we go back to kind of first principles, as it were, and we think about the unions and their engagement with the media, how can unions create and maintain a more effective relationship with the media? Or, I'm thinking particularly of people like Mick Lynch, for example, have they actually taken it as far as they can?
Again, it's a very interesting question, and it's one I have been asked before, actually. And looking back to when I first started, trade unions were pretty poor at press relations, actually. A lot of them didn't even have press officers. It was a national officer or a regional officer would deal with the press. You know, fast forward to not just now, but the last several years, every major trade union has a campaigns and communications department, as it's called, who deal with the press, and they are as good as it gets. You know, some of them are ex-journalists anyway, so they write very good press releases. They've got an eye for a story. They know how to contact. They know how to contact people in the media. The problem has been, up until fairly recently, the lack of interest in trade unions. So I don't blame unions at all. I think they've kind of changed a lot in terms of their media relations. And in terms of Mick Lynch, you know, he's really raised the bar, I think, on how to treat the media and how to give media interviews. You know, a lot of the interviews he's given been quite aggressive, you know, attacking him and throwing out facts which aren't facts. And he's just been great. You know, a lot of other union leaders are in awe of him, really. He's become a bit of a hero.
A joy to watch.
Yeah. Yeah, but he's, you know, he's open, he's honest, he's a bit of humor. He knows his subject, which is the most important thing, I think. He doesn't lie. And he just comes across really well. And even people, what he told me, you know, he was walking in the city a few months ago and, you know, city gents were coming up to him, shaking his hand and saying what a good job he was doing. People who wouldn't normally support the RMT union anyway.
Brilliant. Alan, thank you so much. It's been great chatting with you, and long may your contributions continue to enliven, inform and educate. Thank you very much.
Well, that's very kind. Thanks for asking, Simon. All the best.
Thank you.
Well, I hope you'd agree that was quite a tour de force. And I really hope you enjoyed that chat between Alan and myself. As ever, if you want to follow up on any of the things that we discussed, you want links to some of the stories on Julian Assange or the miners' strike or any of those sort of things, you can head over to the makesyouthink.com website. There's a companion blog there with links, signposting, all the background information you need. That's makes-you-think.com. Well, that's us just about out of time for this episode. Thank you so much for your company over the last half hour or so. Hope you've really enjoyed and liked what you've heard. And thanks to those of you who've made contact with the show following our last episode to let you know how much you enjoyed that and what you thought of it as well. You can comment on the show, get in touch with us by email at unionjews@makesyouthink.com. You can contact us via X at Jews Union. We'd love to hear your views, what you think is good about the show, ways in which we could be even better, if that's possible at all, of course. And also, if you could share, review, subscribe on the podcast platform of your choice, and a 5-star rating never goes amiss at all, that would be hugely appreciated. Thank you so much in anticipation for that. Union Jews is part of the Labour Radio Podcast Network. That's labourradionetwork.org. a portal through which you can access over 200 union-themed local radio shows and podcasts, labourradionetwork.org. We'll be back in a couple of weeks when our featured guest next time will be Unions 21 Executive Director Becky Wright to tell us why and how the organisation is celebrating its 30th birthday in some style. So until then, let's take good care of each other. Let's work together. Solidarity and support to all those struggling to defend their rights or improve their terms and conditions. Thanks again for listening. I've been Simon Sapper, and I'll see you on the next edition of Union Dues. Bye for now. You've been listening to the Union Dues podcast. Music was by Scott Holmes. It was a Makes You Think production.